Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on an update from the CFPB about the proposed debt collection rule, which is being brought to you by VOAP's direct drop voicemail. Now that the comment period is closed, the next phase in developing a debt collection rule from the CFPB has begun. In this webinar, we're fortunate to have Gandhi Eswaramurthy, the CFPB's debt collection program manager, here to provide an update on the proposed rule status and discuss the ins and outs of some of the proposed rule's most impactful provisions. He's being joined by Rick Purr, a partner at Fineman, Crickstein & Harris, who will provide the industry's perspective on this important topic. Before I get too far in to the discussion today, I wanted to make a quick statement and correct an error that I accidentally made in an article that was published on AccountsRecovery.net today. The original version of the story incorrectly identified that the timeline for the final release of the rule was May 2020. That is not the case. I just misread a sentence and jumped to a conclusion and made a mistake. The agency has not indicated that the final rule will be released in May 2020, just in 2020. So I apologize for that error. As I mentioned, this webinar is being generously sponsored by VOAP's direct drop voicemail. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the arm industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the arm industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about today's speakers. Gandhi Eswaramurthy is the program manager for debt collections within the Consumer Credit, Payments, and Deposits Market Group of the Division of Research, Markets, and Regulations at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Prior to joining the Bureau in 2017, Gandhi had more than 25 years of experience working on all aspects of credit card risk management, including risk modeling, account management, collections, and recovery policy and strategy at several large card-issuing banks. Gandhi has a PhD in agricultural economics from Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. Rick Purr is a partner with the law firm of Fineman, Crickstein & Harris and a nationally recognized authority on creditors' rights, including the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. Rick is also a past president of ACA International, a trade association representing the debt collection industry. He advises entities and individuals on matters related to compliance in the credit collection industry, including review, implementation, and auditing of policies and procedures, especially in adherence with governmental regulatory bodies, such as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The format for today's webinar is a discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and once that's concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available later today on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, I want to ask everybody to reserve a minute and fill out the feedback survey that should pop up on your screen today after the webinar is over. You should also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation, your feedback helps me develop the content of what that is what you're looking for and to find the speakers you want to hear from. Definitely the case for the people we have with us today. So with that, let's launch into our discussion. Gandhi, I know I kind of jumped the gun a little bit and said May 2020 today. So my first question is, what kind of update can you or estimate can you provide on the timeline for when the final rule will be released?
Sure. Thanks, Mike. Before I start answering that question, I just want to thank Mike and AccountsRecovery.net for this opportunity. I think Mike knows very well that I attend almost every single one of the webinars that he organizes. They are very timely and great topics for me to keep up with the development. So thank you for that opportunity. As for the question about timeline for when the final rule will be released, right? I just want to emphasize there is no definite date at this point, but the Bureau intends to issue the final rule sometime in 2020. As you all know, the debt collection NPRM was, NPRM was published in the Federal Register in back in May 21st, 2019. And then the comment period ran and was actually extended by another 30 days, and it ended in September 18th, 2019, right? And since then, obviously, the Bureau is very carefully reading all the feedback we received to date. To date, we received like 12,000 comments. And obviously, we will address each and every one of them, whatever is substantive in the final rule. General rule of thumb inside the Bureau we use is any rule of this size and scope, very complex, right? We generally think that it will take about a year from the date the NPRM was issued to the date the final rule will be released. So that's general rule though. Of course, there are a lot of factors that will affect that general timeline of 1 year, which is the comment period itself, which ran 4 months, and then complexity of the rule, and the number and the substantive nature of the comments that we receive. And in this case, obviously, given such a huge rule proposed, you can see like 12,000 plus comments needs to be addressed one way or another in the final rule. And also the rule covers a wide range of topics, as you all know. On top of that, there is a separate research that's going on, which I will touch on that later, but related to the time bar date disclosure, right? So that survey has been completed and the research team is analyzing the results as we speak. And chances are the Bureau will make a decision about whether a supplemental NPRM needs to be released just for that topic, time bar date with the revival concept, right? So if that happens, obviously there will be time for public to comment on that supplemental NPRM. So there are quite a few factors that are at play in terms of determining the timeline for the rule, final rule. Again, on top of that, there is another timeline we need to keep in mind, which is the timeline between the release of the final rule and the date by which the covered entities should become compliant. So today in the NPRM, we have proposed that timeline to be 1 year. That also is 1 year, right? Again, the Bureau was trying to balance kind of two factors, competing factors in determining that timeline for final implementation or implementation period, which is 1 year. One is you want to make sure the rules are implemented as quickly as possible so the benefits are available to all the consumers and other parties as soon as possible, right? So that's one desire. But on the other hand, there is a burden on the entities to become fully compliant. They have to make a lot of changes in their system, perhaps update their policies and procedures, train their collectors and so forth. So that will require a significant amount of time. So we need to balance these two. And at this point, the proposal is 1 year from that release date of the final rule to the date of full compliance. And we have asked for comments about that aspect also. So we would like to hear from the industry whether that 1 year is too short or is it too long a period. So we have received comments about that aspect also. So long story short, both factors, right, from the NPRM release to the final rule, and then from the final rule to the implementation period, both are about 1 year each. But we are analyzing the feedback to make a decision on that one at this point. But the director has made it very clear this is one of the top priority for her. So seeing the final rule sometime in 2020 is a very high probability, except I cannot tell the exact month or date at this point.
So that's an interesting concept from you know what we've seen so far, and I think that the audience members would probably agree, and Gandhi recognizes that you know, it's been a while since this whole process and the road was started way back in 2013. So now we're approaching 2020. You know, there's a couple other factors that could go into the practical implementation of any rule besides the political implications of trying to get something done in a 2020 year and all of the comments that everyone has to go through. Right now, there is that 1 year implementation date, which means that if it, for whatever reason it took to May, as Mike prognosticated, I'll give him the credit there, or into June or the middle of the year, you know, you're talking about implementation into 2021 and maybe even depending upon how late in the calendar year, for a matter of convenience, someone may not just push it to a end of a quarter or beginning of a year. So you could be looking at potentially January 2022, the implementation of a rule. But there's other, two other factors that could impact the finality of a rule. The first of which is the Congressional Review Act. Many people are not familiar with the Congressional Review Act, but it was implemented in 1996. And the goal was to allow Congress to weigh in on rulemaking by various administrative agencies. And what it says is that within 60 days of the passage of a or release of a final rule, Congress, in an expedited legislative process, can, by a majority vote of both houses, strike down a rule that was written by an administrative agency. So why is that significant? It's significant because, well, it really hasn't been utilized successfully too many times with the divided House and Senate in a lot of eras. We have seen it used and utilized by Congress in striking down the arbitration rule that was implemented by the CFPB or attempted to be implemented several years ago. But also because of the nature of some of the comments that we see, at least publicly, from consumer groups and from industry groups, you may be able to, in a sort of bizarro way, obtain a coalition of both Democrats and Republicans in Congress who don't like the rule for one reason or another from each side and could band together to implement an act. So what does that happen if that were to take place? If Congress were to vote and implement the Congressional Review Act, that would prohibit the administrative agency, in this case the CFPB, from further creating a rule in the same form or substantially the same as what it had proposed, which would throw everything into a big mess if that were to happen, because none of the topics or subject matters that were addressed by this rule could be addressed without Congress itself going back in and effectively repealing its own Congressional Review Act implementation. The other area that could put some delays on the implementation of a rule would be if one party in one way, shape, or form were to go to court, and that would be by filing something with the Court of Appeals, probably for the D.C. Circuit, or it could be anywhere across the country, and then there's a random process for how it gets assigned. But challenging various aspects of the rules, much in a similar way that ACH and others challenged the FCC's declaratory ruling in 2015. So we are hopeful that there will be a final rule proposed or put in the Federal Register in 2020. But there are a number of other factors that could impact its ultimate implementation down the line, depending upon what its content is.
Gandhi, I wanted to follow up on something you talked about with respect to the time-barred debt disclosure. If the Bureau decides to issue an NPRM, a supplemental one related to time-barred debt, do you foresee that having any impact in the release of the final debt collection rule, or will those two, do you think, be handled separately, continue to be handled separately?
The analysis and the decision and so forth is obviously handled separately as of now, but the desire is to combine the final output into one rule if possible. But by no means this time-barred debt disclosure supplemental NPRM will delay the original timeline for the major NPRM, right? But best case scenario is chances are high that both can be combined into one package after the supplemental NPRM goes out, comment period closes and so forth. So I think it's because it's such a narrow concept that's being tested, we believe it could be combined, but in no way it will stop the other train from moving.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. Drilling down into some of their provisions now, with respect to the limited content message guidelines that were proposed, do you foresee those needing to be applied to text and emails as well as voicemail?
Yeah, right now the way in the proposal and NPRM, right, the limited content message, the debt collectors can use that in voicemail or oral. As they are on the phone with the consumer, they can deliver that limited content message, but it doesn't make that much sense. But certainly leaving voicemail on the phone and also sending that via text is allowed. The reason is the Bureau believes that doing so in those channels, like leaving a voicemail or sending it through text message, will generate response from a consumer. That's our hypothesis at this point. The proposed rule does not enable the debt collector to do so, meaning leaving a limited content message by email at this point. Email is excluded. The reason is generally email messages require additional information. Like, for example, you have to include sender's email address, right? In some cases, sending that email address alone will reveal the identity of the debt collector, and therefore that would be a violation of in a third-party disclosure risk is there. That's one of the reason why a limited content message is not being proposed to be delivered via email at this point. The other thing is like a limited content message is, by the way, it's a safe harbor, and it's also defined as not a communication under the standard FDCPA definition. So it's an optional one, right? Obviously, debt collectors may choose to use it or maybe don't want to use it. They can always send any other message through email or text that they choose to that is outside of the proposed limited content message. Again, the summary of the response is email channel is off limits for sending a limited content message for those reasons. So specifically, potential third-party disclosure risk about the debt collection.
And to add in there, I mean, I think that at least with current case law and the amorphous nature of texts and emails, you end up with the question that arises of, are they oral communications or are they written communications? And I think with the Bureau, at least proposing that you can utilize a limited content message for texts, and of course orally, sort of puts text, at least to a certain degree, into that camp of oral communications. Emails, I think, you know, it'd be fair to say from a practical standpoint that, but by taking that position, practitioners can treat and understand that they have to treat email like written communication. And you need to have your disclosures. You need to have everything in it. You need to make sure that you're meeting your state as well as federal requirements for written disclosures. And the utilization of a limited content message would run afoul of many of those areas. So it's good to see that. And it's good to see, of course, with text, where we run into a whole bunch of dilemmas when we're communicating by text right now. Because if you're going to treat it at both oral and written, think about the text box and how much space you have and how many messages it would take if you didn't come up with some shortcuts or some short codes for putting written disclosures in there. If you're going to treat it as a written disclosure as opposed to being able to do a limited content text. So it's a good sign, and I think that people would in the industry would welcome the inclusion of a text as a considered to be at least more in the camp of an oral disclosure, so there's some clarity. So that's a very positive development.
Exactly.
Okay, excellent. At this point, I just want to pause the discussion briefly and remind everybody that today's webinar is being sponsored by VoApp's Direct Drop Voicemail. VoApp's Direct Drop Voicemail is happy to be hosting today's webinar. This is a very important topic, and they are happy to bring to the audience. A huge thanks to Gandhi and Rick for giving us this update today. BOAPS wanted to mention that they recently went to Washington to visit with the CFPB in August and met with Gandhi, John McNamara, and their team about the proposed rule. They went to advocate on behalf of the Army industry and explain how much the good actors in our industry are using their service to help consumers handle their financial obligations, help rehabilitate their financial situations, and keep the credit market flowing. The CFPB appeared to be very receptive, and BOAPS appreciates the opportunity to continue that conversation today. So a special thanks to BOAPS Direct Route Voicemail for sponsoring today's webinar. A reminder to everybody, if you have a question for Rick or Gandhi, please type it into your Zoom webinar control panel, and we'll start taking those in the next few minutes. Gandhi, wanted to just to clarify the definition of accounts under the proposed rule. I know there's been some maybe some confusion or uncertainty. Does accounts are accounts to be defined by customer, or would they be defined by each product for which the customer has debt? In other words, if a customer has multiple delinquent accounts, will the issuer have 7 total attempts to collect on all lines of debt, or 7 attempts to collect on each product?
Sure, Mike. Again, as most of you or all of you know, the Bureau's proposal, right, in the NPRM, it does not define the term account. It rather uses the term debt as more common, and also it's adapting this definition of FDCPA for the particular word debt. So whenever we talk about call frequency, telephone call attempt, right, frequency, it's to do with it's actually connected with the collection of each particular debt. For example, except in one situation in the proposal, it talks about student debt. So if a particular debt collector is collecting multiple accounts of a student debt, but under one statement and one account number, but multiple student debt, that's the only scenario where the proposed rule considers that as an aggregate student loan debt to be treated as one particular debt for the cap purpose, right? Other than that, the proposed rule is talking about a particular debt, and it's a 7 attempts in a 7-day period, that is unanswered phone calls. That's one cap. Or if there is one right party contact for that particular debt, then that's the maximum allowed in a 7-day period, right? So that's the cap that is being proposed. Again, it is related to one particular debt. For example, if a consumer has one medical debt and one credit card debt, and both are being serviced by one debt collector, so in that scenario, it's possible they could combine those two products, but the proposal is not mentioning that. In this scenario, there will be a 7 attempts for the credit card debt that is separate from 7 additional attempts on the medical debt, for example, for the same consumer by the same debt collector. So this is one we debated quite a bit before the NPRM was released, whether the cap should be at a customer level, should be at a weekly level, should be at a daily level or a monthly level, and so forth. So there are a lot of different options we considered. So this is one area where Bureau has asked the industry to opine on, like provide comments as to, are there any scenario where certain types of debt needs to be combined for the call cap purpose? For example, we believe there are different types of debt warrant different type of handling, even if it is with the same debt collector, as an example. So we certainly were looking for comments about this aspect, but at this point, it's not about account definition, but it is a particular debt, and it is individual debt level except for student loan.
So here's the interesting thing about this process, and I think that if there's any particular area of the proposed rule that, at least from the industry side, gets the greatest amount of feedback, and really two, one being the model validation notice, of course, which you can listen to a whole discussion about that. The accountsrecovery.net did, I guess it was last week or the week before, but is the call caps and the definitions of accounts and how that applies. And it's an interesting dilemma that the Bureau is faced with, because sometimes what we think or what we see doesn't necessarily correlate to how the area is treated or how the technology lets you deal with it. You know, I think in my head as an analogy, you know, we like to watch shows like CSI and other things, but quite frankly, you know, the technology that they show on the show is, it tends to be more science fiction than science. And the same thing goes with how agencies handle accounts, because you get accounts necessarily from different sources, different clients. The information that's utilized by those clients or gathered or collated that gets sent to the agency can be different or in different formats. Someone's name could be identified differently, or it may or may not have a date of birth or a social security number. Systems don't go in on the entry of new accounts necessarily go back and cull through all existing accounts that it has to coordinate or collate them into a single account. So the technology isn't really there, or the practical way that the ARM industry works, that you can simply say that you have multiple accounts for the same person and that the agency is necessarily going to know that just on its face without having to do some independent hand-wringing of its own. And I think the rule recognizes that in its definition, because the last thing that anyone would want to do would be to impose upon agencies an obligation that they can't practically meet. You're not going to know on January 1st, and we see this in court opinions. You know, a consumer disputes a debt on January 1st if or says, please don't contact me. If the same agency gets a different debt on February 1st, the obligation to cease and desist doesn't carry forward, because how are you going to prospectively be able to determine what account you actually have? And so what we see here is at least an effort by the Bureau to recognize that from a technology standpoint, you can't simply define an account. You don't know whether it's going to be related per se, if it's going to be, as you said, of the Verizon cellular telephone account and a medical debt. If you're even going to use the same name, you're going to call something for Richard Purr versus Rick Purr, and that the system is going to supposed to be able to identify that those two are the same person. And so it becomes problematic in limiting those obligations or what's related in aggregating. Additionally, as another practical consideration is that by collating, aggregating debts, whatever you want to do, besides the technology limitations, you have the fact that sometimes people need to be able to independently dispute or ask for validation only of one portion of that debt. You could have gone through medical procedures, had three or four different medical procedures from the same creditor or doctor, but only have a dispute with one of those bills, not six or seven of them. And so by separating and keeping the account separate allows for the consumer to pinpoint his or her dispute or issue and communicating effectively with the agency about that dispute. So when you get to that fundamental, and by not defining an account as everything that the person that an agency may have for one person, it allows for that flexibility and business practices and practical business practices of the agency. You know, as far as whether seven attempts or not works for each of these debts, you know, you get a different opinion from almost anyone in the agency. I think that you have, some would say that seven is too much, some would say that seven is too little, and others would just say it all depends. What's clear is that you know, the general agencies out there, which are the overwhelming majority, have no interest in communicating with someone excessively or more that's necessary than to identify to identify with the consumer that it's the right person that they're talking to and the amount of the debt is correct. And once they get past that, is to have periodic communications in an effort to try and resolve the situation with the consumer. So while I don't know that we can weigh in and say, yes, seven is great or seven is bad or it's not enough, I think the industry is entirely committed to making sure that they communicate with consumers as minimally as possible, simply enough to be able to identify the right person, the right amount of the debt, and to walk the person through a repayment possibility.
Yeah, those are great points, Rick, particularly calling out the practical issues in combining debt, right? Whether to dispute one at a time or all of them and so forth. Personally, when I managed collections, one of the card issuer, there were two portfolios, right? Branded cards and then retail private label. I managed the retail private label side of it. And even if we placed two accounts for one consumer with the same debt collector, settlement strategy was quite different between these two portfolios. So for a debt collector to, you know, discuss the settlement offer to a consumer on the same phone call about branded cards versus retail private label was problematic. They couldn't, you know, keep up with the details of it. So that's another problem of communicating what's on the table for the consumers, right, when multiple products are involved. And that may lead to prioritization, right? So the debt collector may prioritize one card over the other in terms of getting the limited funds from the consumer, so forth. So that's why, you know, on one hand, at the highest level, it is desirable to have one phone call to a consumer and discuss all the debt that they have with this debt collector. But there are a lot of practical issues that are there. That's the reason why we were very particular about looking at the feedback on this particular aspect. The only thing I can think of is as a debt buyer, perhaps there is a chance for this to work. I'm not quite sure, because once the debt buyer buys all the debt, whether it's now a single owner of the credit at this point, would it make sense to combine? I don't know. So that's a comment we are looking for in terms of making a call, whether we can go one way or another.
And clearly in that type of circumstance where you're dealing with someone who acquires a whole portfolio at a single time, clearly from a technology standpoint, it's obviously easier at least to try and match names, social security numbers, or dates of birth at a singular time, as opposed to trying to go through a system and constantly effectively scrubbing a system back and forth and back and forth as accounts come in. You know, from the agency side, they're doing that on a daily basis if they're getting new accounts. Almost an impossible task, where all you would be doing is spending your time scrubbing as opposed to collecting. You know, just a different scenario in how intake works in those areas.
A couple of questions have come in, so I'm going to pause our discussion for a moment and see if we can tackle these. What happens when you have a medical account from three or four different providers? Can you make seven attempts on each of those accounts, being that they are separate clients and or providers?
Yeah, I think the way the rule is proposed in the NPRM, that's correct. It's a particular debt, and therefore each one is separately handled with the call cap, right? The seven attempts in a seven-day period at this point, right? Particularly for medical debt, that is true. Unless, of course, based on the feedback, if something else changes between now and then, similar to the student loan. But other than that, right now, it is just like any other credit card debt. Medical debt is treated as at a particular debt level. So each one is handled separately as far as the call cap is concerned.
And that comports with, you know, at least some case law that's out there. We saw in a matter, and I don't remember the plaintiff's name, but I remember the defendant, Medical Business Bureau out of Chicago, in which they successfully won a case in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And the trial court had, they were collecting medical debt. The plaintiff said there were multiple accounts or multiple treatment dates the provider provided to the agency, these accounts over a period of time. And plaintiff argued that the agency should have collated all of them, collected them, summed them up, and that should be one trade line issued to the credit bureaus, or the credit consumer reporting agencies, and had one entry as opposed to four or five different entries on the consumer report. The trial court agreed with the plaintiff. It went up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals reversed, saying that each of these accounts have to be treated differently, and that by choosing to report them individually, There was nothing wrong with that, and it wasn't illegal. And I think that this follows through with that same logic that the courts have seen, which is that, you know, just because there is a same agency collecting and there is one individual doesn't mean that you have to aggregate these accounts together, even if it's just all medical, because there are many, many different reasons why somebody would want to treat these areas separately, whether it's the amount that's at issue, whether if there's a disparity in it, whether if it's you want to dispute just one treatment versus the others. So, you know, by not giving the consumer that opportunity and putting this all together, it really hampers also the collection agency in trying to quickly dispose of accounts that are lawfully owed and should be repaid and to which the consumer has no issue with, and then isolating the ones that there are is an issue with, and trying to, as anyone knows, in trying to deal with an issue or a communication about a dispute, it may take more than 7 calls back and forth, because of, for a whole number of reasons, not because it's an attempt to aggravate or annoy a consumer, but just the nature of the back and flow of information that goes back and forth about why something could be disputed or why it shouldn't be owed, or other information that may come back from the provider back to the consumer. And that just may take more than 7 times in 1 week to resolve it. And we shouldn't put barriers on people trying to fix those issues.
Okay, excellent. Another question with regards to consent for texting and email communications. Does that pass through from the creditor to the collector, or does the debt collector need to obtain new consent from the consumer for each debt? And how does that, you know, how would you have any suggestions about how that would work when you're collecting on multiple debts?
I think that's a bit tough one for me. I think there's a lot of discussion about the new channels of or modern channels of communication, right, in debt collection, specifically email and text, and also within that, using those modern channels of communication for required notices versus general collection. So there are a lot of provisions in the proposed rule where the eSign Act, for example, right, requirement consent for sending written communication, required written communication. So there are alternative procedures laid out in the proposal where if a creditor or a prior debt collector has eSign Act consent, for example, from the consumer, then the new debt collector can continue to communicate using that email address, for instance, right, as long as they know the eSign consent was provided to the previous debt collector or the creditor. If they don't, obviously, then they will have to reestablish, the new debt collector has to reestablish the consent. So there are provisions. I don't think I can do justice on this call laying out exactly the alternative procedures to follow when eSign consent is not there for email or text. So that's why I think that's a big provision in this proposed rule at this point, to make it easier on one hand for the industry to adapt this technology, because if you make it harder that each and every single time the debt collector has to get the consent, perhaps the industry may not adapt this new technology for communication purposes. So on one hand, we wanted to make sure that it's easy to adapt, right, for by the debt collectors. But at the same time, we wanted to make sure the consumer's privacy rights are protected so that we don't open up this channel of communication to a point where consumer rights are violated. So there are provisions in the proposal saying, for instance, even though we say like unlimited email and text technically can go from a collector to the consumer, we are requiring that in each and every single communication in email or text, there has to be instructions how a consumer can kind of stop, for example, stop the email or stop the text message, for instance, so unsubscribe or stop the text message. So that control is in the consumer's hand. And then another one is like making sure the consumer received the email and it didn't bounce back. So there are provisions like that in the rule to balance the rights of both sides, the industry as well as the consumer. So again, it's a very lengthy topic. I obviously strongly suggest reading at least this provision of the NPRM to fully understand the consent requirements and consumer protection in terms of privacy, all of that.
Following up on that, there is a question that says, the NPRM says the consent to email text will pass to the debt collector if the creditor recently used that method to communicate with the consumer. And the question is there any guidance on what recently means?
I think I'm going to be on the spot, so I don't want to comment on something that I myself am not sure. I thought internally the discussion was in the past 12 months or so forth. I may be wrong, so please don't quote me on that one. But I think that may be another aspect that needs to be clarified as we follow through the comments, right? That needs to be, there are a lot of factors like these that require additional clarity in terms of the final rule. So certainly this will be one of them in terms of what does that recency mean.
Okay.
And I think that, look, we have some guidance, you know, at least from the Federal Communications Commission with the TCPA, that at least, you know, for people with a pre-existing business relationship, that being the collection agency through the creditor, having a personal relationship as opposed to a cold call solicitation from telemarketers or others, that providing your email address, providing your telephone number, more importantly, it is an indication of your desire or ability to be communicated at that number. And thus, with the TCPA, of course, that constitutes consent. If you give the creditor the number and the collection agency uses it to call or to use it on an automated telephone dialing system, that will comply. So it makes sense to carry that over. But like anything else, I think that the ARM industry has been conditioned, and you'll see with almost every actor out there that they want to communicate with consumers in the manner and method that consumers want to be communicated with. And so that necessarily requires, if you're going to communicate with someone with email and then they want to stop communicating via email, you're going to comply. And the same thing goes with texting or calls or letters. And even though the current description of the FDCPA says that you could send a cease and desist letter under 1692C, the fact is that, and it must be in writing and it applies as a wholesale cease and desist, the fact is that almost any agency dealing with a consumer will take an oral request to cease, will necessarily respond to a partial cease. They will modify or change their communication habits to accommodate the consumer. So the fears of people doing things, yeah, are you going to have bad actors somewhere, somehow, that do things in a manner and in a desire where the intent is not really to communicate but could be harassing? Absolutely. But you can't just necessarily legislate because there's a few bad actors that you're going to penalize everyone else. And I think that as long as you're communicating with consumers in the manner that they want to be communicated with, they're not going to have any complaints.
Okay, excellent. Wanted to maybe jump ahead a little bit, if you don't mind, Gandhi, and ask about the Supreme Court's decision to hear arguments in the case of CELA law versus CFPB, and wondering if that's going to, if you expect that to have any impact on the timing of the rulemaking and or the road to the NPRM becoming a final rule.
Yeah, definitely this is beyond my pay grade. So obviously I can't comment on potential impact to the rules based on that Supreme Court law, Sheila law and versus CFPB.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I checked with the Bureau, but there is no official comment at this point on what the implications could be.
No problem.
I mean, I could throw in my two cents. You probably could have a whole webinar, Mike, on, you know, A, what is the Supreme Court really looking at and examining, and what could be the fallout from that? And I think that you have two real polls, and then somewhere in between those two end polls. The first of which could be, you know, an argument that if the statute as it is has a director, which is improper, and the Bureau itself is unconstitutional, then everything that the Bureau has ever done is void, as opposed to the word voidable, which, you know, have two different legal meanings, which would really put everything in a lot of turmoil if that were the case at one extreme. And on the flip side, you could have a situation in which the court were to decide, okay, even if we do find that there is some infirmity in the removal process of the director, all we're doing is severing that clause, effectively rewriting the statute to say the director can be removed at the, you know, discretion of the president, and that nothing that has happened up until this point will be impacted, and it doesn't change anything going forward. And then you could have something that lands somewhere in between, which could say that everything that's happened since then is not void, but anything going forward can't be done until you fix the problem. In Congress, you got to rewrite the statute, or you got to do something, or put some brakes on it. So we'll wait to see. The nature of the Supreme Court. We already know that Justice Kavanaugh, as Judge Kavanaugh, weighed in on the PHH Corp decision when he was with the D.C. Circuit Court. And weighed in that it was unconstitutional. With the sort of balance of the court and a little bit tilting of a conservative majority, it will be interesting to see what will happen and whether the Chief Justice tries to build some consensus amongst the other justices in coming out with a result that is more unanimous for multiple reasons, so that it can have a united Supreme Court at least determining what the outcome is, even if they disagree as to why it should be that way.
Thank you for that, Rick. Appreciate it. Curious with respect to the comment, Gandhi, do you have any sort of thoughts, any way to characterize the comments? Were there more or less than you thought? Have you identified any potential themes? Any insights you can glean from what you've seen or heard of the comments so far?
Yeah, sure. As you know, like the comment period ended on the 18th, right? To date, we got 12,000 plus comments. Just to put into perspective, right up to the ANPRM, right, Advanced Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, we received 23,000 comments at that time. Compared to that, 12,000 is still a lot in the sense because a lot of questions were raised even for the ANPRM itself. So we were on top of that. This proposed rule obviously covers a lot of ground, right? So we anticipated more comments, and as we expected, we got a lot. And in fact, in the proposal, Bureau specifically asked for comments at least post 200 plus questions. Seeking openly from the industry and consumer advocacy groups comments on those 200 plus items, things like the call cap, limited content message, efficacy of the limited content message, so forth. So the team, the regulations team, which is what writing the rules, they are actually reviewing the comments as we speak, summarizing them, categorizing them at a high level. What I can say is, by the way, all these comments are obviously available to everyone to see on the website regulations.gov, so anyone can go and see the full details themselves. But at a high level, I can say the theme of comments are, like, for example, from the industry side, we hear more often about the applicability of these proposed rules to the first party collectors. particularly under the UDAP umbrella. People who have visited the Bureau and voiced verbally also their concerns, like state attorney generals or other regulators may interpret the proposed rules as extended to first party collections also. So they want explicit clarity around whether or not it is going to be applicable to first party creditors and first party collections. So that's one. And the second more common one is about the limited content message. We asked for industry feedback about what is their current practice in terms of leaving voicemail and how effective is that. We hear some of the comments are like the way the message is proposed, limited content message, may not be effective because it doesn't say a whole lot about the caller or the creditor or so forth, right? So in the age of spam calls, spoofing and so forth, leaving such a message may not enlist like a lot of inbound calls, for example. That's a comment. So they're asking for more clarity about, can you do more than what is proposed? Can we leave, for example, this is regarding your credit card from Bank of America, for instance, which again strays away from revealing more about the potential debt, right? So that's a kind of delicate balance. That's another set of comment. And then there's also comments about like a legal authority that the Bureau has, even in terms of issuing such rules. For example, the call cap, there are people raising questions about what legal authority does the Bureau have in terms of specifying a numerical value for call cap. And also defining a particular communication as not an FDCPA communication. So that's kind of a legal question comment. And then on the consumer advocacy groups, we hear quite a bit, obviously, about the call cap itself. So they feel it is still too many, number one. And number two, question about opening up email and text without limit. Even though we have built into that a lot of consumer protection features, like the opt-out on every single communication and ensuring that the consumer has a good email and it is not a workplace email and the email did not bounce back, things like that, right? So in spite of all that, the consumer advocacy group still provided a lot of feedback about saying that this is too much in terms of opening up the channels. And I think on top of that, there are a couple of areas which were surprising, like the meaningful involvement of attorney. That's a topic that generated a decent amount of feedback. And I think those are the topics that stand out for me from what I heard to date, the common themes.
Here's an interesting question I actually have had myself. I'm curious. What's the CFPB's position on receiving the same form comment over and over? Is it an effective way for a group to voice concern?
No, I think obviously the when I say the 12,000 is the total number, and then when they categorize the what I call substantive comments, because a lot of times we receive like a one-line comment saying like, of course there are maybe profanities or like those kinds of but cleaning out all of those things, looking at the substantive comments, there are comments generally for or against saying like this is a great move for the industry, whereas it's a bad move for the consumers, and without any other additional meat around the comments. So if you leave all of that out, if I remember the ANPRM, for example, out of the 23,000 comments, 600 are very substantive, very detailed, like running several hundred pages or like tens and hundreds of pages, touching on each and every aspect of the proposal. So we do take that into account. So just because somebody is like literally copying the same comment over and over does not create any extra weight for that. We look at the merits of the comments in terms of addressing them in the final rule.
Okay.
Did I answer your question? I wasn't sure if I got
that. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Appreciate it. we talked a little bit before about consent and things like that, and curious with respect to how the proposed rule is going to interact with the TCPA. You know, the FCC is working on an update to the TCPA. So I'm curious, you know, how the Bureau might be engaging with the FCC about those questions, such as defining an auto dialer, which is something we mentioned, you know, Rick mentioned before. Are there any other outstanding compliance questions that could limit ability to send text messages, for example?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. Definitely, there is overlap between the use of newer technology, especially text in debt collection and the TCPA, right? The Bureau is definitely aware of the FCC's work, as you know, the ruling, right, from the ACA versus FCC. So we are following that very closely. Restrictions on auto dialer, right, is something the Bureau definitely hears about, and it's a space that we encourage continued dialogue, not only with the industry folks, but also with FCC. Again, you may, the audience may be aware of the fact that Bureau filed a comment with the FCC to underscore this importance, right? That the auto dialer should be defined and resolved. The issue should be resolved quickly. And we even offered to work with FCC on this matter and other issues. I know the offer is out there. I'm not quite sure in the frequency or the forum of how the regulations team or the law team from the Bureau is working with FCC, other than the fact that I know they're closely tied to this sister agency in terms of this development.
Rick, is there anything you wanted to add on, you know, sort of the interplay between the proposed rule and, you know, what's coming with the TCPA?
Well, I mean, I think that it's tough to say that there's necessarily an interplay. I think that they're, you know, at least on its face, they're sufficiently separate, and that the industry has to be mindful of adhering with both, even though that certain technologies may be utilized. I don't think it's giving anybody a carte blanche just because you can do it, that you have permission to do it without other requirements of the law, no different than anything else. And I think the courts would view it the same way, which is that statutes don't necessarily either preempt each other on the federal level. We see that a lot with the FDCPA and the FCRA. So any rulemaking in that regard, I think it's nice to see governmental bodies working together, but unless it's expressly identified, we just need to assume that you got to still follow everything that's involved. And nothing is from one agency is a carte blanche to do something that another agency hasn't expressly said is okay.
Excellent. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the top of the hour, which means we're just about out of time. But before I let Gandhi and Rick go, wanted to give them the chance to offer any concluding remarks or a summary of what they talked about, anything they didn't get a chance to address but wanted to. Rick, would you mind going first?
Sure. I want to thank, first of all, Gandhi and the CFPB for not just appearing on this webinar, but in being out there publicly at the numerous events across the entire industry that we've seen over the past several months and going forward. It's been helpful to ask these questions. I think it's helpful for guidance for everyone. To under significant changes, at least in doing business, in some respects they're welcome changes. In other respects, you've seen comments and they've been posted that would suggest some clarity or some refining some of the edges. But I think as an overall first push into this area, the CFPB should be commended for taking a hard listen to both consumers and to industry participants, and trying to do and come up with a balanced approach to both continuing to maintain privacy and respectful dialogue between agencies and consumers, and at the same time, understanding that the U.S. economy depends on third-party collection agencies to recoup money that's lawfully owed to creditors, and that they can't put too many barriers in place that would be injurious to the rest of the people who are would be impacted by increases in cost of goods and services. So kudos to the CFPB for what they've done. We look forward to seeing the final product, hopefully incorporating many of the industry's recommendations. And thank you again, Mike, for everything that CountRecovery.net does in presenting this to the public.
Awesome. Thank you, Rick. Thanks for your participation today. Gandhi?
Not to take a lot of time. Again, thank you, Mike, and accountsrecovery.net for this opportunity. I think when I joined the Bureau 3 years ago, after many years on the other side of the fence, it was a perfect timing for me to get involved with the rulemaking. Obviously, the FDCPA, 40-plus-year-old statute, right, and many years of work was underway even before I joined. If people recall, the original intent was to propose a rule that's applicable to all, like, first-party collectors as well as third-party and debt buyers, right? Based on the feedback from ANPRM, the then-director, Richard Cordray, made the decision to focus only on FDCPA-covered entities at this point. So I think it's still a lot of ground that's being covered in this proposal. It's a great effort by the team, and initially I thought it's a huge undertaking. It will take a lot of time. I may not see the light at the end of the tunnel at all. But to my own surprise, here we are. The NPRM is released, and very good indications that all the conferences that I go to, I hear very positive feedback from the industry. And even on the consumer advocacy groups, there are some positive signs about opening up new channels of communication. So it's a matter of ironing out the quirks at the periphery, for example, based on the comments. So I'm very delighted and positive about the outcome that's going to come out very soon.
Awesome. Well, excellent. Well, Gandhi, Rick, thank you so much for taking the time to share your insights and information today. I really appreciate both of you spending an hour working to educate and inform the industry. Gandhi, I'll echo Rick's comments that the CFPB has been, I think, been very public and very open and very accessible throughout this this period, and I appreciate that. I want to thank VOAPS one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.voaps.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated today. Really appreciate it. Please be sure to fill out the feedback survey to help identify topics and speakers that will be of the best use to you going forward. A recording of this event will be posted later today to accountsrecovery.net. I hope everyone enjoys the rest of their day and has a great holiday week. Thank you very much. Rick, Gandhi, awesome job. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks.